Okay, thank you for your patience. It's very important to have the evenings like this and to prepare for Pesach, not only physically cleaning, but thinking also. And if we don't prepare and think about what Pesach means, we may end up making a Seder like the following story. An elderly couple never made a Seder in their life. And finally, they're getting on in years, and the husband says to the wife, you know, who knows what's going to be in the future? I would hate to have to go to the next world without ever having made a Pesach Seder. So maybe this year we should make a Seder. The wife said, that's very nice, but we have no idea what a Seder is all about. She said, I thought of that. Our neighbor is the rabbi. I want you to go Pesach night and look in the rabbi's window and see what he's doing. And we'll do the same. You'll report what he's doing, we'll do the same thing. Comes Pesach night, sends his wife to look through the rabbi's picture window, and the rabbi comes home from shul, and he sees that his wife isn't prepared, the table's not set, the house is a mess, and he starts yelling at her. And she starts yelling back, until finally it comes to actual blows. He starts hitting his wife. The wife runs back home, and the husband says, okay, what do we do? And the wife is quiet. She won't say a word. He says, I sent you over to see what the rabbi is doing. What do we do? Quiet, won't say a word. Finally starts yelling at her. I sent you over to see how we make a Seder. Tell me what we do. Finally, he gets so exasperated, he starts hitting her. He says, you knew how to make a Seder. Why'd you send me over there to look? We don't want to end up with a Seder like that. So it's important to prepare and to think. And usually we think about the Exodus from Egypt, and that's what we spend most of our time discussing and contemplating. But the truth is that if you don't understand that which necessitated an Exodus, the bondage in Egypt, and what its purpose was, and then there's really no purpose to celebrate the Exodus. Give me an example. Imagine somebody walking down the street and minding his own business. Someone comes along with an iron pole and breaks both his legs. The person now is writhing in pain on the sidewalk with both his legs broken. And the man with the iron pole comes over him and he thinks he's going to finish him off now. This is it. And the man says, I mean you no harm. I'm an orthopedic surgeon who needs practice. So I broke both your legs. I'm going to take you to my clinic. I'm going to heal you for free. And in 6 months, you're going to be walking like nothing ever happened. And he does that. Takes him and he heals him and takes care of him. And in 6 months, he's walking like nothing ever happened. How much of a thank you does he owe this orthopedic surgeon? Zero. He owes him a lawsuit. Because if he hadn't broken his legs, he'd be walking like nothing happened 6 months earlier because nothing would have happened. So let me ask you, don't we believe that God controls the world? Not pharaohs and not Hamans and not anyone else. So how do we get into Egypt to begin with to be oppressed? Because God let us get in there. God orchestrated all of that. He got us into Egypt. Who took us out of Egypt? God. So if God put us in and God took us out, why do we owe many thanks? Don't put me in Egypt. Don't take me out of Egypt. I didn't come here to convince you not to celebrate Pesach this year. So there must be an answer. The answer is very simple. My analogy is not a good one. The proper analogy would be the following. Let's go back to the guy walking down the street, minding his own business, but he doesn't know that he has a rare disease. A disease of the legs, which I made up, which I have the right to. I spoke to Rabbi Weiss. I can make up any marshal I want. It's part of my rights over here. So I can make up diseases too, and they can fit exactly what I want them to do. This disease of the legs has the following pathology. Person who has the disease doesn't even know he has it. It incubates for 10 years. And during those 10 years, has no very, very few symptoms. Only a trained eye can really see from the way that a person walks that he has the disease altogether. After incubating exactly for 10 years, the person's legs, the bones of his legs, disintegrate, and he will be a cripple the rest of his life, and there is absolutely no cure. There is one way of curing this, however, before it reaches the 10-year point. Before the bones disintegrate, if you break the bones and reset them, the bones will grow back normal, and the person will be cured. Now let's go back to the guy walking down the street, minding his own business, unaware that he has this disease, and the orthopedic surgeon walking behind him is an expert in the disease, and he notices from the way he's walking that he has the disease, and there's 5 minutes left till the 10-year point. What does this orthopedic surgeon have to do? Immediately. Find an iron pole and break this guy's legs immediately. He can't tell him, why don't you come by to my office tomorrow? Because tomorrow, in 5 minutes, the man's legs are going to disintegrate, and that's it. So therefore, he has to act quickly, break both legs, and then he tells him, you're a very lucky man. He says, can you explain why I'm a lucky man with both legs broken in terrible pain? He said, yeah, because in 5 minutes, your bones of your leg would have disintegrated, you never would walk again. Now I'm going to take you to my clinic, and I'm going to heal you. It's going to take 6 months, and in 6 months you're going to be walking like nothing ever happened. And he does that, and he charges him for it. Does he now owe him a thanks? For what? For healing him, or also for breaking his legs? For also breaking his legs, because that was part of the healing process, and without that the person never could have been healed. Had his legs never been broken, he wouldn't have been as well off as after having the legs broken and healed. Because his legs had never been broken, he would have been much worse off. His bones would have disintegrated. Sometimes we do things that cause us to be spiritually ill. And the Rabbanu Shalom knows, just like there is a physical order, there's a spiritual order. And unless our legs are broken and something drastic happens, if we just stay on the same course, things will be really, really bad. So the Rabbanu Shalom is forced to let us have our legs broken and then to heal us. And ultimately, when we're healed, it's the product of both the negative and the positive together. That's the reason at the Seder, Matzchilim b'gnus u'mesayimim b'shevach. We start with the bad, avodim hayinu, mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu. We start with the bad, and we end with the good. Because if you don't understand that the bad and the good are both parts of this process of healing, then there's no purpose to thank God for the good. So we have to include the bad also. And that's why matzah represents both slavery and freedom, because they are two sides of the same coin. They always have to go together. And that's why a nes is two letters, nun samech. The nun represents nefila, falling, and the samech means to support. God makes us fall, and through the falling he supports us. So therefore I thought that we would discuss tonight, what was the purpose? Why did we need 210 years of Egyptian bondage? What was the flaw that the Jewish people had that needed to be corrected? And the correction was the bondage in Egypt. The Gemara Nedarim asks this question and says what on the surface seems to be a fantastic answer, which is has questions from beginning to end. So if when I say it, it doesn't make sense to you, that's good. If it does, you can leave. But if it doesn't make sense to you, don't worry about it. We have a lot of questions, and we're going to give what I think is a decent answer to all of them. The Gemara says like this, Machot Avraham Avinu, v'nishtavid bonav v'mitzrayim mosayim v'esther shana. What sin did our forefather Avraham sin that necessitated his children being enslaved in Egypt for 210 years. And then the Gemara gives three opinions. In my estimation, they are not arguments, they're not different opinions which argue on each other, but they all represent different aspects of the same idea. The first opinion is that Avraham Avinu exhibited what seems to be a lack of faith. God promised him children. He promised that his children would inherit Eretz Yisrael, and Avraham Avinu said, "B'mo'ed ki roshenu." How do I know? How do I know that they'll really get Eretz Yisrael? Seems to be a lack of faith. It's questioning God. So because he questioned God, his children were punished that they should be enslaved in Egypt for 210 years. Second opinion. Avraham Avinu hears that his nephew Lot is captured by four kings who defeated, right before that, five kings. Lot is taken out of Sodom with a lot of other people and taken captive. And his life is in danger. And not only is his life in danger, but there's a tremendous desecration of God's name going on. Because Lot and Avraham Avinu looked alike. They were like twins. So when Amraphel, Nimrod, the arch evil king, captured Lot, he found an excellent opportunity to say that he captured Avraham Avinu. I'm sure the BBC would have reported that for sure, without checking. It's definitely Avraham Avinu, right from the battlefield. In any case, so Lot, he put in a cage, gagged him, and he went around parading him through the streets. Avraham Avinu was obviously not the messenger of any true God, because I captured him. He's in this cage. So Avraham Avinu has no great armies. He has 318 people learning in his kollel, in his home, Torah scholars. So he tells them, listen, we have to go save Lot. So close your books, close your Gemaras, and come with me, and we will save the life of Lot and prevent this tremendous Chilul Hashem also. So they go out, and it's not a six-day war, it's a six-hour war. For 6 hours they fight, and they are victorious over the four kings, and they repatriate all the people of Sodom, including Lot. Says the Gemara, that was the sin of Avraham Avinu. Because he took these people who were sitting and learning Torah, and he took to save the life of Lot, also in Gari of the Talmidei Chachamim, that's why he was punished. Okay, we'll get to that. Okay, that's the second opinion. Third opinion. When he came back from that war, so he brought back a tremendous amount of Sodomim, right, who the king of Sodom said, look, you can keep all the booty, just give me the people back so I can be king over somebody. Avraham Avinu said, you take everything. I don't want a shoelace from you. You can take all the booty and all the people. I don't want anything. Says the Gemara, that was the third sin of Avraham Avinu. He did not attempt to bring these people that he brought back under the wings of God's presence. Meaning he didn't bring them home and try to be mekar of them. He didn't try to influence them to accept the seven mitzvahs of Noah, to believe in God, to go away from idolatry. He didn't bring them under the wings of God. He let them go back to the king of Sodom, back to their evil ways. And because he didn't attempt to influence them, therefore he was punished. Okay, now, this is astounding. First of all, let's assume that these three things were sins. But we have a rule. People don't suffer for other people's sins. Lo yunsu avos al bonim, v'lo bonim al avosam. Children don't suffer for their parents' sins, and parents don't suffer for the children's sins. So if Avraham Avinu did these three things wrong, then why wasn't he put into Egypt for 210 years? Why his children suffer for something that Avraham Avinu did? One question. And second question, that's assuming that these were sins. Still doesn't make sense. But if you look at each one, what was the sin? The first one, he doubted God. That's not true. God didn't understand there was a doubt over here. Rashi says right over there, what did Avraham Avinu mean when he said, "Bamo Eda"? How do I know? He didn't mean, prove it to me. I don't believe a word you're saying. What he said was, God, I believe you 100% that my children will inherit Eretz Yisrael. In what merit? What merit do my children have to inherit Eretz Yisrael? That's all he asked. And if you think God misunderstood him, he didn't, because that's what he answered him. He told him in the merit of the sacrifices. So he obviously understood what his question was. So what kind of sin is that? To ask what merit the Jewish people have to get Eretz Yisrael is a sin? It wasn't a lack of faith. It wasn't questioning God. So the first thing doesn't seem like a sin. Second one. He took these people, stopped them from learning Torah, to do what? To save a life? There's something wrong with that? Person is sitting learning Torah by a lakeshore, and somebody's going down for the third time. What's he supposed to say? I'm sorry, I'm learning Torah. Can't help. If you can tread water till, you know, till Ben Azmanim, right, you know, Zman will be over in a few months. Be glad to help you, but right now I'm learning Torah. It's absurd. You have to stop learning immediately and save the life. So Avraham Avinu had nobody else to depend on. To go out alone and fight. He has only these 318 people in his house. He needs them to save a life. Something wrong with that? What was the sin? And lastly, he didn't bring the people of Sodom, wasn't the car of them. Who are we talking about? We're not talking about some estranged college youth, you know, that you can bring home, give a nice Shabbos meal, and maybe influence them. We're talking about the people of Sodom. 2 pages later in the Chumash, these people were annihilated because they were the dregs of humanity. They were the worst kind of people you could ever imagine, who are incorrigible. Avram's supposed to bring them home and endanger all the people he has in his house, all the Balei Tshuva, by exposing them to the people of Sodom. Of course he couldn't influence the people of Sodom. God destroyed them 2 pages later. So obviously they weren't the kind of people that you want to bring home, right? Hey, we have somebody, a Shabbos guest, the people of Sodom. What was the sin? Because he didn't feel that he was capable of bringing these people tachas kanfei Hashem. So, it seems that these things aren't sins. I mean, if they were sins, we don't still understand why if Avraham Avinu sinned, his children should suffer. In order to understand this, want to give you a brief overview of what the purpose of the Jewish people is and how that's supposed to be achieved. And when we understand that, then we'll go back and understand what this Gemara is talking about. And we'll understand why we ended up being in Egypt for 210 years. And we'll even understand the Seder a little bit better also. Mir Tzashem. What is the ultimate purpose of all of us, all Jews? So we don't have to go anywhere farther than the Torah itself. The Torah is very explicit. What is the purpose of the Jewish people? The Atem Tihiyuli Mamleches Kohanim the Goy Kadosh. You will be to me, says God, a nation of Kohanim, a nation of priests, and a holy nation. What does that mean? A Kohen is God's servant, totally devoted to God, and represents God to the Jewish people. When you want to give something to God, you give it to the Kohen. Pidyon HaBen, you want to give God 5 shkalim, who do you give it to? The Kohen. The Kohen is God's personal representative to the Jewish people. And we are the Kohanim of the world. We are God's representatives to the world. How do we represent God to the world? We don't go around handing out his calling card. I represent God. You need him? Give me a call. No. How do we represent God to the world? By being a Goy Kadosh, by being a holy nation, by living a life that represents holiness and divinity. And in that way, we represent God. In order to be God's representative, you have to be totally negated to God. You have nothing of your own. You are an extension of godliness, an extension of God. When someone looks at you, he sees that godly extension. And therefore, in order for the Jewish people to develop as a mamleches kohanim, the goy kadosh, all the accoutrements of nationhood had to come about by and be based on God himself, not as other nations develop with their own means, with their own ideas, with their own development. But the Jewish people had to be totally founded and based on God. What makes one nation different than another nation? What are the qualities that define a nation and separate it from another nation? In my estimation, there are 3 things. Every nation has its unique identity. It identifies with the land that it occupies. It identifies with various character traits that that nation may have. Every nation is different. The Germans have certain character traits that identify them, and Germany has certain traits about it, the land that identifies the German people. France has certain characteristics, they may have some characteristics that represent them, and so on. Each nation has an identity that sets it apart from all other nations. Then there are the resources that that nation has that set it apart from other nations. Some nations have oil. Some nations have chicken schmaltz. Some nations have resources of, they know how to keep a beat with music or whatever. They may not have anything physical, but they have, they are certain resources. Other nations have precision, wisdom in technology or whatever. The resources of the nation are what they use their identity and are able to express that identity through their resources. And finally, putting the identity and the resources together, what's the purpose of that nation? What do they contribute to the welfare of the world? What is their unique contribution, their purpose? Those are the three aspects of nationhood that set one nation apart from another and make them a nation. And we're going to repeat this tens of times throughout the next few minutes. Identity, resources, purpose. And therefore, Avraham Avinu was told way at the beginning when God chose him to be the progenitor of the Jewish nation. God said to him, Avraham Avinu, you're 75 years old. You have already developed a certain identity. You've developed certain resources. And you have certain goals and purposes. I want you to leave them all. Lech lecha me'artzecha. Leave your land. A person identifies with his land. I want you to leave this land. Give up your identity to a certain degree. Mimoladetecha. From your birthplace. When a person's born, his mazel determines bonei, chayei, mezonei, his resources. I want you to leave your birthplace. Leave your resources. And your father's home, your goals, your purpose, your projected purpose in the world. Leave that too. V'lech lecha, go to Eretz Yisrael, el ha'aretz asher arecha. V'etcha l'goy gadol. I'll make you into a great nation. I'll give you your identity. Your identity will come from me. I will build it. It won't develop slowly like other nations. I'll make you a great nation. I will bless you with resources. I'll give you your resources. I'll make your name great. I'll give you purpose. And that way you will be the blessing to the whole world. You will be my representative to the world. Had Avraham Avinu developed these three areas without any blemish, then that's how the Jewish people would have developed. Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov. And finally, the Jewish people would have grown into a nation founded and based on a firm foundation of identity, resources, and goals, and purpose that are founded totally on God and given to them completely by God. A nation that God made. Am zu yotzarti li tehilasi yisaperu. This is a nation that I created, that I made. I made them into a nation, says God. The problem occurred. And Avraham Avinu didn't sin in the idea of doing something wrong, per se, but he blemished that foundation of nationhood in all these three areas. And this is what the rabbis tell us in the Gemara Nedarim. Let's see the first one. Avraham Avinu questioned, what merit do the Jewish people have to get Eretz Yisrael? Sounds like an innocent question. But it sets into question the entire identity of the Jewish people. That question raises doubts as to what our identity is. You know why we have Eretz Yisrael? The Medrash says, Omad vayimodeid oretz. The Ribono Shel Olam measured every land. And he found no land more suitable to the Jewish people than Eretz Yisrael, and no people more suitable to Eretz Yisrael than the Jewish people. We fit each other like a... Why? We are a holy people who represent God, and we have a special relationship with God, and Eretz Yisrael is a holy land that has a special relationship with God and represents it. It's his land. So what could be more proper than the Jewish people, who are identified as a holy people with special divine providence, should get Eretz Yisrael, which has the same exact properties? If you question what merit do the Jewish people have, that means that we are not exactly the same as Eretz Yisrael. We need some outside merit to get the land. That already puts our identity into question. Then what is our identity? If it's not exactly what Eretz Yisrael is, then what is it? And because Avraham Avinu asked that question in all the worlds, for a second, there was a doubt as to the identity of the Jewish people, and that set a blemish in the foundation of our identity. And what did God answer him? What is the merit? We don't need any outside merit. The merit is sacrifice. Sacrifice represents the essence of the thing. You bring out your essence when you bring a sacrifice. The Jewish people don't need any outside additional merit to get Eretz Yisrael. All they have to do is express their essence. Their essence and the essence of Eretz Yisrael are identical. But because Avraham Avinu asked the question, it raised doubts in all the worlds as to the identity of the Jewish people and blemished the foundation of the Jewish people as in their identity. Next. Avraham Avinu took these people who were learning Torah, took them out to save a life. We said that nothing wrong with that. That's what you're supposed to do. But not because saving lives are greater than learning Torah. Because the rabbis say it's not. The rabbis say, G'dola Talmud Torah, Yoser Mehatzolos Nefoshos. Learning Torah is greater than saving lives. How could that be? Learning Torah is greater than saving lives. Yeah, you know why? Because we believe that when a person learns Torah, he keeps the whole world going. The world would cease to exist if there was no one learning Torah. And every person who learns Torah makes the world a more secure place, gives the world more existence, makes it a place that has more energy to exist. If no one would be learning Torah, the world would cease to exist. So every time a person learns Torah, he keeps the world going. He makes everyone exist more. When you save a life, you're only saving a specific life or a number of lives, but you're not keeping the whole world going. So learning Torah is greater than saving lives. However, the same God that said that learning Torah is greater than saving lives said he wants you to save lives if it comes in conflict with learning Torah. Not because it's a greater thing, because that's what God wants. Prove it to you. Not always do we do the greater thing. We're going to come to the night of Pesach soon, and we're going to have to eat matzah. Chewing on all that matzah, almost choking, very impossible to learn at the same time. So if a person is learning Torah and comes the time to eat matzah, he has to stop learning Torah and eat matzah and concentrate on eating the matzah so he doesn't choke to death. So he has to stop learning. Does anyone here think that the mitzvah of eating matzah is greater than the mitzvah of learning Torah? It's not. Talmud Torah, Keneged Kul. Talmud Torah is greater than the mitzvah of eating matzah. Yet the same God who told us to learn Torah and told us that learning Torah is greater than eating matzah told us that when it comes to eating matzah, Leil Pesach, I want you to stop learning and eat the matzah. That's the law. But not because it's a greater thing, but because God wants you to do the lesser thing. There's reasons that God has why he wants you to do the lesser things too. They're also important. So even though you're involved in a greater thing, I want you to stop and do the lesser thing. So the truth is, Avraham Avinu did what he had to do. He took these people to go and save Lot's life. But had he been on a higher level, perhaps, Lot never would have come into such a situation to necessitate using these people for a purpose less than the ideal purpose. An example of what that means. Let's say you have a stack of $1,000 bills, okay? There is such a thing, $1 million in bills. If you don't think that's a lot of money, could you see me after this year? In any case, you have this big pile, right, $1,000 bills. You're driving somewhere in Vermont, or in Montreal, or somewhere where it's cold, and you're stranded, your car gets stranded. and you have a very luxurious car that has inflammable upholstery, you're wearing clothing that is inflammable, you have nothing in the car that you can possibly make a fire with except the $1,000 bills. And you start to get cold. And you realize that if you don't build the fire, you're going to freeze to death before they find you. The only thing you have to make a fire, a bonfire, is your $1,000 bills. What would be the proper thing to do? Not to die a millionaire, but to burn those bills to make a fire. But would it be, to a certain degree, a waste of the value of those bills to make them into a bonfire? Under the circumstances, that's what you have to do. But you're taking the bills and using them for something less than their real value, making a bonfire of them. Same thing. Under the circumstances, it is mandated to save those lives. But those 318 people could have been doing something much more exalted and saving the entire world by continuing learning Torah for those 6 hours. The fact that Avraham Avinu was not on that high level, where his merit would save Lot from being captured altogether and necessitating using his greatest resource. What's the greatest resource the Jewish people have? People who learn Torah. That's our greatest resource. To have to use that resource for something less than its ideal already blemished the resources of the Jewish people. The foundation of the resource of the Jewish people was blemished by Avraham Avinu having to take these people to save the life. And lastly, sure, Avraham Avinu had no choice. He could not take the people of Sodom home and risk influencing the people in his home through these dregs of humanity. But when the world looked at Avraham Avinu giving back these people, they said, well, what is the purpose of the Jewish people? Right? They didn't say it consciously, but this is what aroused among the spiritual powers in the world. It seems to put into question, what is the purpose of the Jewish people if Avraham Avinu can give back souls, people, and not attempt to try and bring them under the wings of God? Then he's not fulfilling his purpose of being a light to the nations of the world. True, he couldn't do it. He did what was right. But the fact that he had to do that blemished the purpose of the Jewish people. Comes out that the very foundation of the Jewish people as God's people was blemished in all three areas, in its identity, in its resources, and in its goals and purposes. What happens when you have a foundation that is cracked? Okay, anybody here a builder? You don't bring super glue and put it into the crack. If you have a wall on the third floor that has a crack in it, you bring plaster and you fill up the crack. No problem at all. Building will be fine. But if in the foundation there's a crack, you can't put plaster, cement, and fix it up. You know what you have to do? You have to destroy, dig up that part of the foundation and relay it. You can't patchka with it. You have to reset it. You can't fill a crack in the foundation. You have to take away the crack and relay that part of the foundation. You don't have to take away the whole foundation, but you have to at least take away where the crack is. And therefore God said, since the Jewish people had been blemished in their foundation, in their identity, resources, and purpose, I'm going to have to do something that takes away all these three areas to a certain degree. I'm going to take away their blemished identity, their blemished resources, and their blemished purpose, and rebuild them from me in a twinkling of an eye to make them my nation and give them back these three things, but directly from me. How did God destroy, uproot the blemished foundation? To take away identity was the first aspect. Gerus. He told Avraham Avinu, Ger yezaracha beretz lo lahem. Your children will be strangers in a land that's not theirs. Strangers in a land that's not theirs takes away your identity to a certain degree. You're swallowed up by a host nation, you lose your identity. So for a certain amount of time, they were strangers, and that took away their identity. Next thing, they're going to be enslaved. Slaves lose all their resources. Mashakona Evet Kona Rabo. What a slave works, goes to his master. He has no resources. His own body is not his own. His own time is not his own. Totally bereft of resources. So God stripped them of their resources by making them slaves. And lastly, Inui. The Inu Osam. They will afflict them. What kind of affliction? How much work, hard work, is called affliction, and how much is not affliction? The answer is it has nothing to do with how hard you work. It has to do with purpose. If you can work very hard, but if you feel you're accomplishing something, it's exhilarating. And you can work not so hard, and if you feel you're accomplishing nothing, that is avodas perech. And that is the halachic definition of avodas perech, because we have a prohibition not to work a Jewish slave, avodas perech. And the explanation of that prohibition is, don't give him work that has no purpose. Only purposeful work, not purposeless work. That's why when Paro wanted them to work, he made them do things that had no purpose. They built storehouses, store cities for Paro. The Torah calls them Orei Miskinos. The Medrash says, Al Tikrei Miskinos Ava Miskinos. They were pitiful cities. They built them on sand, that when they finished building them, they fell down. They had to build them again. They never accomplished anything. That's why when Paro wanted to give them more work, he said, I'm not going to give you straw. You're going to have to work double and do the same amount of bricks. Now, Paro wasn't stupid. If I was Paro, I'd make them work double and give me double the amount of bricks. I would gain double. Why would he make them work double and give the same amount of bricks? The answer is because if they had double the amount of bricks, they'd feel accomplishment. He wanted them to work and feel no accomplishment, working twice as hard and accomplishing nothing more. And that's why the word perech, if you transpose the letters aleph to tav, beis to shin, you transpose the aleph beis, that's called etvash. Perech, if you transpose the letters to their opposite letters, the pei becomes a vav, the resh becomes a gimel, and the chaf becomes a lamed. Vav, gimel, lamed, if you add up those letters, they equal 39. What is 39? The 39 works of Shabbos. What did those works accomplish? They built the Mishkan from those works. The most purposeful work ever existing was the 39 malachos that went into building the Mishkan. It is the exact opposite of perech. Perech is purposeless work. This is the most purposeful work that there was. So the inui, the affliction, which is making them work without a purpose, took away their purpose. And then the Rebbe Shlom said, now we're ready. I've uprooted, I've stripped away your identity, your resources, your goals, your purposes, through Gerus, Avdus, Inui. Now I'm ready to build you into a nation, but first a preface, says God. I want you to observe a nation that is the opposite of what you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be a nation that understands that its entire existence depends on God. I want you to look at the Egyptians. They are the antithesis of that. They're a nation who felt that they're self-made people. Paro said, I made the Nile. Self-made people. The opposite of what the Jewish people are supposed to be. And I want you to see how bankrupt their identity, their resources, and their goals are. And that's why God brought the 10 plagues first. To show us how bankrupt Egyptian society was in all these areas. And the 10 plagues were brought in three groups. Tzach, Adash, Ba'achav. There's no time to go into great detail, but a little bit. The first three plagues, Dam, Tzvardeya, Kinim, blood, frogs, lice, showed that the identity of the Egyptians, which identified with the Nile and the land of Egypt, is bankrupt, is decrepit. How? Let me just give you one example. We could go through all 10 like this, but there's really no time and it's not necessary. Let's start just with the first one, which I'll tell you a little bit more in detail, and then we'll see the other ones in general. In my estimation, the plague of blood made the following statement. God created us. He gave us our life. And there's a liquid that forms the life force of the human being. What is that liquid called? Blood. And if everything goes well in your life, you don't never need any transfusions, and it's like a worry-free battery. The liquid is put in the beginning, you never have to touch it. The blood is there, no problem. That's God's contribution. He gives you your initial identity. But God doesn't want us to be robots. He wants us to be active, dynamic. He wants us to enhance our lives. So he said, in order for that blood to remain life-giving, you have to ingest another liquid. That's your contribution. What liquid is that called? Right, water. When the Egyptians said, we're self-made people, we made ourselves. We don't have an identity given to us by a God. We're self-made people. What did they conceptually do? They took the blood and they changed it into water. Instead of blood, which is God's contribution, they conceptually made it into water. So you know what God said? You want to change blood into water? I'll show you what happens when I change water into blood. I'll change your contribution into blood. Let's see how far you get with that. That was the first plague. And then, when the identity that you think is self-made, right, it becomes putrid and the fish die and it stinks. And from there come frogs, which are noisy and harmful. And finally, Canaan. Man, God created the world for the sake of man. And he cleared the world and made dry land that the world should be a platform for man to exist. A man that understands that he's God's creation. God created the world for him. And the world is a platform for him. But when you blemish your identity and you think you're self-made, you don't realize that God is the one who made you and you have to live up to a divine image. You think you're self-made people. Then not only isn't the world a platform for you, but the earth that's normally a platform for people turns into lice, and the person becomes the platform for the lice. He becomes the base where lice live. So not only is the world not to his base, he becomes the base for little lice. That's how man is denigrated, by thinking he's a self-made person. Those are the first three plagues. The next three affected the resources of the Egyptians. The first resource was their homes. A person's home is his castle. The Aroth, the mixed multitude of animals, destroyed their homes. They had no privacy, they had no home. Animals came in, out, elephants. I mean, imagine, what's it called? You couldn't close your door, elephants come in, elephants go out. Well, what kind of house would you have? That's Aroth. Dever took away their cattle, their prized holy possessions. And Shechem took away their bodies. That's also a resource, person's body. So their resources were taken away and showed how decrepit they were and how bankrupt they were because they were based on self-made people and not people who were in the divine image. And the last four, Ba'achav, Bora, the Arbe, Choshech, Makas, Bechoros, took away their future, their purpose. Bora and Arbe took away their immediate food supply and their long-range food supply. If you have a food supply, you have no future. Choshech took away their ability to function, and Makas Bechoros took away the next generation. No purpose, no goals, no future. After God showed the Jewish people how decrepit and bankrupt the antithesis of what they're supposed to be is, then he redeemed them and refashioned them and made them overnight into his nation through the three expressions of redemption. Now, I know there are four expressions of redemption, but it doesn't fit into what I'm saying. So we will reduce it to three. That's not really fair. So I'll tell you that the Vilna Gaon says that there really are only three expressions of redemption. So if that's the case, why do we call them four? So he explains the following. Really, there's six expressions in the Torah. V'hotseisi, v'hitzalti, v'go'alti, v'lokachti, v'hevesi, v'idatem. Six different expressions in those few psukim. So how do you decide that there's only four? Says the Vilna Gaon, unlike others, the only ones that are called l'shonos of ge'ula, expressions of redemption, is until the word v'go'alti. After that is post-redemption. Until the word v'go'alti is ge'ula. after the words that go out, the post geula. Those can't be counted as the expressions of redemption. They're after redemption. So how many words are there till the goalti, the hotsesi, the hitsalti, the goalti? Everywhere it says there are four, says the Vilna Gaon, yes, there are four. There are three that are four. How come? Because when it says the goalti, I'll redeem you, it says it with two different aspects. The goalti etchem bizroa netuya, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm, uvishvotim gedolim, with great judgments. So there are two aspects to redemption, with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. That counts as two. There's two aspects of the goalti, and in addition, vahotseisi, vitzalti, altogether four. But there's really three, and one of them has two aspects to it. Now let's see how it fits into what we said. God rebuilt us and gave us our identity by taking us out from amongst the Egyptians. Vahotseisi etchem. What made us lose our identity? We were swallowed up by a host nation. We were given back our identity by being taken out from that nation. Vahotseisi. That gave us back our identity. Then the Hitzalti etchem me'avodasam. I'll save you from being a slave, from their work. What took away our resources? We were slaves. Whatever we own belonged to our master. Now God says you're not slaves anymore. And I'll give you resources. You'll leave Egypt rich people. It's your money. You'll be paid for the work that you did. So we left with resources. God gave us those resources. And lastly, we were given purpose. They go, I'll redeem you and give you purpose. Now, what are these two aspects of being given purpose? Sometimes the problem with fulfilling our purpose comes from within. We're lazy. We're not interested in doing our purpose. So God needs to stretch out his arm and give us a good kick and a push. You should want to fulfill your purpose. Sometimes we want to fulfill our purpose, but there are outside factors that prevent us. Goyim, that won't let us fulfill our purpose. So God needs shvatim gedolim. He needs great judgments to take away the outside factors that prevent us from fulfilling our purpose. Those are the two aspects of redemption. Redeeming us that we should want to fulfill our purpose from within, and redeeming us that we should be able to fulfill our purpose and not be stymied from without. Now let's see how that fits into the Seder. According to what we just described, the four expressions of redemption represent these four different aspects. Identity, that's the Hotseisi. God will take us out from the host nation and give us identity again, totally made by him. He'll give us back our resources and make us not slaves anymore. And he will give us purpose in two ways, with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. These four expressions correspond to the four cups of wine that we drink during the Seder. Let's see how they correspond. What is the first cup, which has to do with identity of the Jewish people? When do we drink the first cup? Kiddush. What does Kiddush speak about? The identity of the Jewish people. Asher bochar bonu mikolam, v'romamonu mikolashon, the kiddushon mezosav. It's all a subscription of what the Jewish people is all about. So it fits perfectly. The first cup corresponds to the identity of the Jewish people that was given to them by the redemption from Egypt, and it corresponds to Kiddush. What about the second cup? When do we drink the second cup? After the Haggadah, right before we're going to go wash and make a motzi and eat matzah and moror and korech, and the whole table is still there. Sometimes it's a shame. You have such a beautiful table, and then you're starting, and there's moror over here and matzah over here and crumbs, and this one spilled the wine already, and it looks a mess. You know when it looks the best? If you could take pictures, you know when the picture will be taken? Right at that point. You finish the Haggadah, you're ready now, everything is still perfect, all your resources are in front of you. That's when you make the second kos. That's when you make the second cup of wine. Over your all your resources that are there sitting on the table. So the second cup represents the giving back of our resources. That's when we make the bracha. What about the third cup? The third cup is benching, Birkas HaMazon. Now what in the world does Birkas HaMazon have to do with the purpose of the Jewish people from within? That God gives us a push with an outstretched arm to fulfill your purpose. So let me tell you, it fits beautifully, at least according to my understanding of benching. If benching would only be Thank you, God, for the food. That benching should be short and to the point. One blessing. God, the food was delicious. There was plenty of it. I thank you very much. See you next meal. Right? That's my, what my benching would be. Right? Okay, maybe put a little flowery words in or whatever with a few thous and these or whatever. But that's basically what benching would be. And that's the first bracha in benching. Hazon es hakol. But there are two other blessings from the Torah. The second blessing, you have to mention bris, Torah, Eretz Yisrael, life. The next blessing you have to mention, the Davidic dynasty, the Beit HaMikdash, Yerushalayim. I mean, I ate one measly sandwich. We have to go through a whole refresher course in Jewish history for it. What does that have to do with the sandwich I ate? Why do we never think about this? Why do we mention all those things in benching? I'll tell you. Because I want to really thank God for that sandwich that I ate. In order to really thank him, I have to appreciate how important it is. It's the whole importance of that sandwich just it tasted good. So that's a minimal importance. Thank you, God, tasted good. I like eating things that taste good. But the sandwich did more than that. It gave me life. Added a few calories. Added some more energy. Extended my life a little bit. Life is important. So now, it's not just good-tasting food. It's food that gives life. Oh, it's more important. Now I can thank God a little bit more because that eating that sandwich was life, not just good taste. But now, what's life all about? How important is life? If I'm thanking God for giving me a little bit extra life, an extension of life, more intense life because I ate, now I have to understand how important life is. Life is not all that important, then again, my thank you is minimal. If life is more important, the more important it is, the more the thank you is. So I go through a whole discussion of what life is all about. Bris and Torah and Eretz Yisrael and Beit HaMikdash and Malchus Beis David. That's what life is. And eating this sandwich gave me the ability to be part of all of that. Wow, that's really important. Now I really thank God for that food. So the whole idea of benching is to recognize the purpose of everything. So it fits beautifully. So the third cup, which it represents, fulfilling our purpose from within, fits benching perfectly. And the last one is hollow. What does hollow speak about? Hollow speaks about all the miraculous deliverances that God made to save us from people who would want to stop us from fulfilling our purpose from the outside. The Shvatim Gedolim, the great judgments. So all of the cups at the Seder fit beautifully to the ideas that we mentioned. The identity is in Kiddush. The resources is in the second cup. The purpose from within is in benching, and the purpose from without is in hallel. That's what the Seder is all about. So we start with understanding the blemish. We needed to be slaves. We needed to have our legs broken. Because had we not had our legs broken, then we would have been much, much worse off. The whole foundation of the Jewish people was blemished. God had to uproot that blemish. He had to strip us of those blemishes by putting us into being strangers, being slaves, being oppressed for 210 years. It wasn't a punishment. We're being punished for what Avraham Avinu did. But in order to make up for the blemish that Avraham Avinu caused, the Jewish people had to develop in this way. It was the only way that was possible. And by developing in this way, it took away the blemish. It built our foundation on a firm basis. And we have the chance to develop into that nation that is Mamleches Kohanim Begoy Kadosh. So at the Seder, we should think that we have that potential. Each and every one of us as an individual is God's representative. And as a nation, we're God's representatives. And we should be able on Pesach to recharge our batteries, to get a little bit more clear what our identity is, what our resources are meant to be used for, and what our purpose is to strengthen that and the entire year to live as individuals. And hopefully to see the day, Ki Meitzeischo Me'eretz Mitzrayim Arenu Niflos, as God did miracles for us in the past when he took us out of Egypt, so will he do miracles in the future and hopefully in the near future when he brings us to our ultimate goal of really being his chosen people and really representing to the world what we're supposed to represent and to really be that Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh V'Vias Goel Tzedek M'Hirav Yamin.